This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm reading the end of the chapter called Going to Extremes in the book Eye of the Albatross by Carl Safina. We're in the Hawaiian island chain of atolls in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Last week, we were aboard a cabin cruiser off of Midway Island with David Aitano, who has been a fisherman all his life, started out early as a kid fishing on both the East Coast and the West Coast, learning all about fish populations, dreaming of making money while fishing, and he's spent his life studying tunas, the population sizes, where they go. He's been marking hundreds of thousands of tunas with tags, and then studying the returns he gets when they're caught. And if you look up David Aitano, you'll still see that he is very active researching tuna populations and working to make that fishery more sustainable. We're going to return to Tern Island, where we were at the very beginning. Only researchers have access to it. Unlike Midway, where you can go, they limit people going to Midway to 100 at any time. Amelia,
a Laysan albatross,
the bird with the satellite transmitter, who's raising a chick with her mate, have a huge chick now on Tern Island, and we will see what Carl Safina is up to at this later stage. Here on Tern Island, there's been terrible storms and rain and strong winds and a lot of death among these young sooty tern chicks that have just hatched or are a few weeks old or even still in the egg. So there's been a lot of mortality and yet a lot of survival. We're in the month of May. And Carl Safina writes in a chapter called Going to Extremes, by late afternoon, there is sun enough to throw the first shadow in 2 days, but the sun is fleeting, and soon the pattering rain again sogs in. Nighttime settles uncomfortably on us like a soaked blanket. In the darkness, an intense round of howling from the shearwater startles me from a dream set outside a tiny church amid the woodlands that, as a boy, I have loved and seen destroyed. But here on Tern Island, I found again that sense of spiritual home amid natural richness, not destroyed this time, but cherished and protected. The places for me that come closest to holy, that provide that sense of connection to something large and eternal, are places still capable of bringing forth an abundance of creation. Here amid the profusion of life, the profusion of death remains always in view. Nests fail. Chicks starve, adults vanish, competition intensifies, violence lurks. The animals are hunters, all, sometimes of each other. Predation is the common currency. Chicks are legal and tender. Here is always the struggle to be alive again at dawn. But here too, and this is the point, enough balance and enough nurturing exist that species can maintain their presence in great abundance for millions of years, even as they are continually hammered and shaped in the stern, unmerciful forge of natural selection. The net effect, the final verdict, the balance of proof is the triumphant vitality, the bewildering plenitude. If anything can be considered right, this turbulent throng of life seems right because it works durably and enduringly. Rain again all day, fieldwork canceled. The assignment board now says simply, clean up. Everybody does. The kitchen gets cleaner and more orderly than I've ever seen it. The entire living and dining area is crisscrossed with clotheslines that seem to grow like a spiderweb as load after load of long overdue laundry emerges. Soon it's hard to get from the kitchen counter to the dining table without numerous sheets and hanging underwear dragging across your face. Outside, the wind breathes not a whisper. In fact, there's been no wind in the last 2 out of 3 rainy days. This weather system is still just sitting on us. Adult albatrosses, so hurried to leave in days past, are lingering today. At one point, I count 6 black-footed albatrosses and 1 Laysan within 100-foot radius, more than I saw on the whole island when I first returned. They'd rather give the weather time to move than risk flying into dense rain and no wind. One Laysan albatross seems torn between waiting and leaving. After feeding its chick, it spends 17 minutes merely standing at the nest and then walks toward the shore. It opens and closes its wings slowly several times as though undecided, walks several steps with wings open, then folds up. It walks over to one of the other adults, sits, and accepts a few minutes' neck preening, but it quickly becomes restless, walking along the bulkhead, raising a ruckus from the sooty terns whose colony it is walking through. As if the protests and jabs from the sooties are just too much hassle in this unpleasantly crowded neighborhood of strangers, the bird runs forward with open wings and in a few quick flaps launches northward. It has spent 23 minutes ashore. In a few minutes, the albatross vanishes into an approaching curtain of fine rain. I hunch as I feel my t-shirt soaking through, then splatter and slop my way through the runway puddles. The albatross chicks look bedraggled, but all seem old enough to have survived. They're preening a lot. Rainwater rolls down their backs and wings, while the absurdly matted down on their heads and necks drips like soaked and matted moss. Inside the barracks, with all the laundry and cleaning done, the biology staffers are writing copious letters home. By afternoon, Shiwei says, "I feel like I've written to everyone I've ever known and everyone I'll ever meet." There's nothing left to do but cut hair. Before dinner, National Geographic producer Greg Marshall prepares to give his sound woman and wife, Birgit Buhlier, a haircut. She says, "Make it short," but she's a little shocked to see how well Greg follows her instructions. Birgit's hair had been down to her elbows. Now it barely touches her ears. Brendan receives a haircut so radical that people greet him by rubbing his head. The mealtime music tonight consists of the Gypsy Kings, followed by Jimi Hendrix's Manic Depression. Now it's the gentle side of John Coltrane, including My One and Only Love with Johnny Hartman, surely one of the most soul-saturated recordings ever captured in any musical idiom. While I'm inhaling Coltrane's exaltations, Mitch and Melissa are preparing what Greg is already promoting as a serious pizza orgy. It's going to be quite a night. A gecko lizard pours itself out of a small hole in the cement block wall just behind Greg's right ear. One or two geckos remain visible on the kitchen walls throughout the dinner hour. A brown noddy flies in and finds the kitchen counter an appealing resting pad. Its close observation of the food preparation brings little comment. We've all grown very accustomed to birds. This noddy's behavior is testimonial to individuality among animals. I imagine that individual distinctions among people are as visible to them as individual distinctions among wild animals usually are to us, that it seems to them that all those people look the same. After dinner, real blue appears overhead. The evening has gifted us the calmest sea and the most beautiful sunset of the trip. The sun setting glorifies the air with color. Billowing clouds are towering into a sky that grades from pale at eye level to very deep blue at the zenith. The lagoon again tints the soles of the clouds green, while the cloud tops rise rose, peach, and gold caught from the sinking sun. Add a pastel pink tropic bird as a beauty mark. The colors are all in fluid motion, changing as the sun drops. The visual is so stunning, the beauty so pumped up, it's enough to inspire you to fly 2,000 miles in it yourself. Even the runway, full of sheeted puddles, is reflecting the sky, somehow catching the lagoon's green cast off the clouds as the first evening star appears. Catherine comes out onto the porch, spreads her bandaged, sun-blistered arms wide, and bursts out, "It's so gorgeous!" Morning. Storm warning. We wake to more rain. The fine morning that evening promised. With a glimpse of blue, dawn has withdrawn. The wind has swung again and blown the cloud system back upon us. After yesterday, no one has much to do, so we talk, getting to know one another a bit better as the day dreams along. Catherine, who graduated from college 2 weeks ago, is saying, "I had no idea when I wrote the application letter that it was this remote. I was just thinking about, you know, Hawaii. Right before I came out, I downloaded pictures from the web. All my parents' friends and my non-biology friends said, 'Oh my God, what are you doing? You're crazy.' So I thought, 'Oh my God, what am I doing? I'm crazy.' But from the minute the plane landed, I thought, 'This is going to be great.'" Shiwei Wang, whose black shoulder-length hair is pulled back into two tight Chinese pigtails, says, "My mother was planting thoughts, waving her finger like this, saying, 'Do you know any of these people you are staying with? Do they have a criminal background?'" She giggles almost convulsively. Shiwei graduated with a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering, but says, "I didn't want to sit in front of a computer all day." She rediscovered her childhood interest in the oceans while working at the University of Washington's Chemical Oceanography Department. "Suddenly I realized you could do something with the oceans as a career, and I thought, 'You mean happy and have a career?'" After Turn Island, she'll be going to Alaska for another Seabird project, and she got notified today via satellite telephone that she's been hired to work on penguins in Antarctica this coming winter. Meanwhile, Greg is telling us how he came to produce special films for the National Geographic Society, explaining that he'd become fascinated with fish as a child, but, he adds, "I was derailed for a lot of years in college. I was convinced I couldn't be a marine biologist. My father had scared me. No jobs, no future, no money. He wanted me to get into law. And I did a pre-law curriculum, but after a couple of years, I just realized, damn it, I want to do marine biology." So he's earned a master's in his desired field. His main invention for animal study has been the Critter Cam, a camera that attaches by suction to marine animals. Quote, "One day I saw a shark go by with a remora attached to it, and suddenly a light bulb went on. If I built a camera body with a suction attachment like a remora has on its head for hitchhiking on sharks' bodies, we would have access to a new world of underwater time and space." Unquote. This allows the animal to be the filmmaker, giving us unprecedented views of what creatures do underwater. For instance, Greg says that with the camera, quote, "We were amazed to learn that the monk seals here, instead of chasing fish, are overturning rocks on the bottom and rooting around in the sand, eating a lot of eels and octopuses," unquote. Here's something interesting about monk seals and sharks. There's a small shark in these waters that lives a kind of parasitic existence. It rushes in to hit a larger animal like a seal or dolphin or whale and twists out a circular, palm-sized scoop of flesh, leaving a round scar. It's actually called a cookie-cutter shark. Monk seals generally don't get bitten by cookie-cutters until they're about 2 years old. Presumably, until that time, they're not in the deeper water where cookie monsters live. It may take the seals that long to develop the lung capacity and skills to dive to between 200 and 500 feet. Monk seals appear to do most of their hunting at night. That's where those big eyes come into play, which is when lobsters and octopuses are out. They eat perhaps the widest diet of any marine mammal, roughly 40 prey species, from pelagic squid to fish, crabs, and the aforementioned lobsters and octopuses. Greg concludes, "And so we found surprisingly that these seals aren't foraging in the shallows, which everyone thought was their crucial habitat. They're going out deep, where people are fishing." Unquote. Before dawn, I realized the rain seemed finally to have ended. For the seabirds, it's been trial by water. The surviving youngsters might as well get used to it. Despite the forays of frigate birds, so many sooty-turned chicks remain alive that windrows of them move through the vegetation ahead of me, fanning out of my way. At first light, the eastern half of the runway is cloaked in a carpet of adult sooties, probably 50,000. Birds begin drifting away from the island in the half-light, silhouetted against the morning. As sunlight begins flooding the sky, birds continue peeling off the runway in a great confusion of wings and deafening sound until turns so fill the sky that the island seems to smoke. The sooties are still so loud by mid-morning that I can't hear the plane approaching. Alarmed, their collective roar is ear-splitting. Off the plane comes National Geographic cameraman Bill Mills and shark researchers Chris Lowe and Brad Weatherby. They will be collaborating on the Tiger Shark film. Chris Lowe, age 35, has been studying Hawaiian sharks for 7 years. He grew up on the New England island of Martha's Vineyard in a family with a 200-year-old fishing tradition. Chris's uncle operated the last coastal schooner in New England. His grandfather, a commercial fisherman who couldn't swim, lost a son and a brother to drowning and fishing accidents. When my grandfather started, he made a living fishing with just hand lines, no nets. He can take you to the beach and point and say, "You see that buoy? We used to catch cod this big there." They used to go just 5 miles offshore to harpoon swordfish. That's all gone now, too. Unquote. So Chris's route to fish research was a logical extension of his family background. Quote, "On Martha's Vineyard, there wasn't a whole lot else for a kid to do besides fishing. I started reading books, one thing led to another, and I ended up doing science." Unquote. Chris got fascinated with sharks and their relatives, the rays. As a graduate student, he studied electric rays in Southern California. Quote, "Those things are just incredible. Think about an animal that can produce and deliver 50 volts. Enough to make a fish contract so violently its spinal column snaps, yet itself immune to the effects of that kind of power. I studied it, and I can tell you, nobody's ever figured out how they do it." Unquote. Chris adds that the electric discharge is energetically very expensive for them to produce. Even rays have high electric bills. Consequently, the rays are conservative with their power. For defense, they use small pulses, just enough to discourage a potential predator, but when catching food, they give it all they've got. Chris says, "Here's what else amazes me. In most ways, sharks and rays are the same as other animals. They eat, mate, give birth, but in other ways, they're incredibly unique. They have sensory capabilities no other animals have. They can detect animals hidden in sand by perceiving the weak electrical fields living things produce. Some sharks apparently migrate by orienting to the very weak electrical fields created by the friction of water masses." Unquote. Chris's research partner, Brad Weatherby, 39, worked in Hawaii for 9 years, including his PhD research at the University of Hawaii. He says, "When I was younger, like most people, I thought sharks were fascinating because they were dangerous. Later, I realized sharks are not well studied compared to most fish. As a scientist, you could pretty much pick a topic and gain a huge amount of information that had never been known before. They have unique adaptations for reproduction, internal salt balancing, and sensory perceptions. People think they're primitive, but they're quite remarkable." Unquote. For his dissertation, Brad studied adaptations of deep-dwelling sharks, some living as far down as 4,500 feet. Quote, "Their eyes and many other parts are adapted to the specific depths and pressures they live at. This totally fascinates me. Shallow water sharks keep swimming to avoid sinking, but for deep sea dwellers, there isn't enough food to be constantly on the go, so deep sea sharks have to find some other way to avoid sinking. The thing is, the deeper you go, the denser the water is. So the bodies of sharks that live deeper are denser than sharks living shallower. Yet I found that all deep water sharks are neutrally buoyant. They neither sink nor float, regardless of the depth and water pressure. Different sharks accomplish this in different ways. Most use large amounts of oils stored in the liver, but others fill their muscles with oil, and some flood their bodies with water, and young ones achieve neutral buoyancy differently than old ones, and males do it differently than females. In some species, males live deeper than females, or young ones live at different depths than older ones. Their physiology is woven into the ecology of the animal. The whole process is amazingly dynamic and complex. Unquote. With time for an evening stroll, I hit the runway just before sunset with Shiwe and turtle researcher Julie Rochko. Julie's just awakened from her all-day sleep for her all-night work. She's wearing the unofficial uniform of Tern Island, a loose t-shirt and shorts, over a bathing suit and earrings in the form of her study animals. Wedge-tailed shearwaters newly arriving are clustered on the runway in two squadrons. I sit and count 92 in the first group, wondering where these shearwaters have been, the millions of square oceanic miles represented by the sight of a few dark birds. I know only that they spend the non-breeding season off of Central America and then follow the equatorial current westward toward the islands to breed. Newcomers accrue gliding in with masterful sheer watery grace. Fluid though they are in flight, they land with an abrupt halt. Their feet seem to stick to the ground immediately upon touchdown, jarringly stopping their forward momentum. After that, they do not seem to walk so much as motor determinedly head down with a two steps at a time waddle. They seem greatly relieved when after a few steps of progress, they sit back on their pink haunches. After watching the shearwaters, Shiwe suddenly interjects, "I think that all the tube-nosed birds, the petrels, shearwaters, and albatrosses, have a musky smell, and that each species smells differently." She continues, "The Bulwer's petrel has a very strong musky smell that I find very relaxing. I inhale it, and it just makes me very happy." Unquote. She giggles a little nervously. I say, "You sniff chicks?" Quote, "Sometimes when we go out at night banding young albatrosses, I just inhale them," she answers. If she was unashamed about sniffing birds at first, talking about it is only emboldening her. The ashy storm petrels I worked with in California, they're really teeny tiny little birds, have a stronger scent, kind of oily, and, she continues stridently, "I really like the way they smell." I nod. She adds, "Not that I go around smelling birds all the time." I add, "No, nothing like that. I like to sniff the ashy storm petrels right around their little bellies, and the albatrosses smell best right around their head," she says. "But the Bulwer's petrel," Shiwe adds, "I've never smelled anything like them before, not ever," unquote. I'm trying to figure out whether this is a plea for help, but then Shiwe says something simple that actually gathers this all together quite sensibly. "Other birds don't smell as distinct to me as the tube noses." Suddenly I get it. Scent is important to bonding and individual recognition in many mammals, of course, and it's important to attraction even in human couples. But tube noses are among the few birds with a well-developed sense of smell. They use smell to find food, to locate their burrows, and probably to identify each other. Their distinct scents, which Shiwe seems unusually sensitive to, help them find the right burrows and identify and be identified among their mates and young. It's particularly interesting that Shiwe says the albatrosses smell best around the head. They must think so, too. They spend so much time nibbling there. Some scientists have speculated that albatrosses like to preen each other around the head and neck because it helps them to remember their individual scents. Lesson taken. When someone says something that seems crazy, listen carefully and search for the truth that might be in it. All night, every night, I hear those wedgies' low voices from bed, playing the bass line to the sooty's frenetic bebop. At times the chorus gathers volume enough to wake me fully. A gecko might announce its presence in my room by uttering an occasional chirp that sounds like a smoke alarm telling me the battery has run low. It can be maddening or pleasant. I choose to make it pleasant. Let it blend with the moaning birds outside the window. I almost don't want to sleep too soundly. I want to savor the soothing of all the call and response talking. But almost inevitably, I drift into a deep, pleasant, and richly dreamful, animal-animated sleep. And I'll stop there. I'm reading the end of the chapter called Going to Extremes in the book Eye of the Albatross by Carl Safina. Don't forget, all of my shows are archived at WDRT.org under the podcast archives. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.